Uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
So, I'm going to start this conversation off by making you a promise, Edward, and that promise is that I will not post this with a picture of the Terminator when we post it. That is my promise to you. Can you introduce yourself to the lovely people and tell us the title of the book that you have written?
So I'm Edward Geist, a policy researcher at the RAND Corporation and author of the book, Deterrence Under Uncertainty, Artificial Intelligence and Nuclear Warfare, which was published late last year by Oxford University Press. So I'm here as author of this book and not as a representative of either the RAND Corporation or its sponsors.
This is a topic I've wanted to talk about in depth for a long time, because I've been in a lot of rooms with a lot of researchers, and a lot of people will talk or give presentations or write a lot of papers that talk about how AI is going to change nuclear weapons. And inevitably, I ask like the follow-up question, well, how? And I don't get great answers. this book actually gives some concrete answers and kind of walks through how artificial intelligence is going to change nuclear weapons and nuclear policy, and what kind of new fears that we have kind of on the horizon. But I want to say that like the audience for this show is a tech audience, well-versed in AI, but perhaps not a nuke audience. So I want to get a clear definition of a term up first, because I think it's going to be important to everything else we talk about. And I know that we could probably spend the next hour defining this, but can you tell me what deterrence is?
Ah, yes. So this is heavily loaded. As I mentioned in the book, it's become what Marvin Minsky termed a suitcase word, where much like the term consciousness or intelligence, where so much meaning has been laden into this term, and people just argue past each other because they're actually defining it differently. Deterrence is very similar. It's the deterrence over the years has come to be used to refer to so many different things simultaneously, has been invoked by so many different people to mean so many different things that too often in the discourse, it's effectively meaningless. And this is regrettable. But originally, there's a formal meaning to it that strategic theorists have. And there is sort of the historical, more traditional meaning of it. Basically, the original meaning is the idea that you want to dissuade someone from doing something, like some sort of aggressive action, and you want to dissuade them from doing it through the threat of punishment if they commit that action. So this is distinct from other kinds of dissuasion. So for instance, dissuasion by denial, right? While some people use the terms deterrence by denial, I personally don't like that because it doesn't fit either the original meaning of deterrence or the Latin roots of the term deterrence. It's the ter part is referring to it's the same root as terrorize, right? It's this element of fear is core to the concept. So dissuasion by denial, for instance, would be this idea. It's we have splendid missile defenses. You can attack us and nothing will even happen. And you're not going to bother trying to attack us because it won't work. And therefore you are dissuaded. I would argue that that is not the same thing as deterrence. Whereas opposed to you nuke us, we nuke you, and you will all be worse off than we are now. So why are you going to do that? That would be an example of what I would term deterrence.
Right. The idea that kind of, and I think this may be shocking to people that aren't in the nuclear space, kind of the policy, or maybe not even the policy, it's more primal than that. The theory that kind of underpins nuclear weapons across the entire world is if one person launches them, they all get launched and the world is over. So no one launches a nuclear weapon. I know it's more complicated than that.
I remember in high school learning about this, like, mutually assured destruction.
Yeah, mutually assured destruction and sort of, like, omnicide aren't the same thing, though. So, admittedly, like, mutually assured destruction is also one of these terms. It's not quite as bad as deterrence, but it's gotten to be much more freighted. Like, this originally had a political context and a meaning. Today it's often used as shorthand for the idea that it's like, well, no one will start a nuclear war because they won't win it, mm-hmm. right? Historically, it had a more specific meaning that came out of the Kennedy administration and sort of analyses that were done. Originally, like, there's this term assured destruction that was used by analysts in the Pentagon to evaluate different defense programs during the Kennedy administration. And so there was, like, assured destruction and damage limiting was the other one. And so there were like these sort of, like, cost benefit studies, just like, oh, do we buy fallout shelters? Do we buy anti-ballistic missile systems? Do we buy additional weapons to try and destroy Soviet weapons before they can be launched? So on and so forth. And they do these calculations. And one of the things that comes up is that the only part of the damage limitation program that was cost effective was the fallout shelter program. But it turned out that Congress killed the fallout shelter program for reasons of its own, with the result that there was congressional support for the ADMs, but you did the cost benefit analysis, even though the analysis that was done at the Pentagon on the, at this point, it's like, I guess it's Nike and then Sprint. It's like they're putting their finger on this, like, the analysis, trying to bias it in favor of the missile offenses. Doesn't work, right? So McNamara starts talking about, because basically he's trying to get Congress to stop demanding, like, additional weapons that don't appear to be cost effective so he can focus on other things, like, say, the war in Vietnam. And so he starts talking in public about it. It's like, oh, like, we're, like, assured destruction, which is the idea that we want to be able, after the Soviets throw sort of, like, everything they can at us, to have enough left over to make sure that we can destroy enough of them that they will be very sorry. And so one of my predecessors at RAND, who at this time had left and gone to the Pentagon, a guy named Alan Entoven, and he's the only one of these early nuclear strategists who's still alive. And so he told me personally the story, is because he was like, oh, yeah, it's like McNamara asked me to come up with some sort of, like, definition of how much is enough. And he was, like, wandering, like, walking the halls of the Pentagon. And by the time he finally got back to his office, he was like, oh, well, it's like there's a knee in the curve over here where it's like you keep nuking the Soviet Union. They just run out of cities. And so it's like you just do make that figure the knee in the curve. And it's about 401 megaton weapon equivalent. So we're just going to make that the criterion. And then and so the thing is, like, in practical terms, like, this is probably overkill, both in terms of deterrence, but it was also the way that they went about assuring, like, 400 weapons delivered was also overkill. Because at the time, the U.S. could arguably deliver that after a Soviet disarming strike attempt with any part of the nuclear triad, right? It's like the submarines could probably do it, the missiles could probably do it, and the bombers, even though they were not normally thought of as being, like, an assured destruction force. This is back in the era when they had not just airstrip alert, they've got airborne alert. It's like the bombers are also highly survivable, if rather dangerous. It's the reason we stopped doing those alert modes. So it's like, oh, well, we've got it covered. It's like we got suspenders, a belt, and an extra belt. It's like the Soviets are going to have to come up with, like, a whole lot of stuff in order to get around this, right? And so this becomes assured destruction. McNamara starts talking about assured destruction. People who are in favor of, like, missile defenses, especially, but also civil defense, start talking about how this is sort of like, oh, well, this is defeatist. And a guy named Don Brennan, who co-founded the Hudson Institute with Herman Kahn, came up with this term, mutual assured destruction, or MAD, intending to make fun of this argument that is like, oh, well, like, everyone will die in nuclear war. It's like, you know, we should have defenses and so on and so forth. The funny thing, though, is that the people on the other side of that debate embraced the term after a few years. And so then it became this universal notion of, like, MAD being something that the late Robert Jervis emphasized and still needs to be emphasized is that mutual assured destruction, It's a fact, not a policy. And if it's defined in terms of, like, but these studies back during the Kennedy administration I was referring to, right? It's like, well, they had a threshold in them for the amount of damage that they thought that the U.S. could take. And it's actually, like, by our quotidian standards, it's an astonishing amount of damage. It's, you know, it's like, can we build between, like, trying to go first or go for second? It's like between counterforce to try and destroy their stuff before it can destroy us, and whatever defenses we can build, like bomb shelters and anti-ballistic missile defenses and like the air defenses to try and shoot down Soviet bombers and all of that. Between all of those things, can we get the expected U.S. civilian casualties down to some like remotely acceptable level? And remotely acceptable in this case could be, you know, like millions and millions of people. And the answer was no, even in an era when the Soviets are not at parity, are still very far from parity. And so McNamara being, you know, this, I guess my take on McNamara in this case is that he's sort of like this bean counter. Almost. It's just like he asked for these cost-benefit analyses. The cost-benefit analysis come back and says, like, well, like the cost-benefit of this is like, it sucks. It's like, it's really expensive and it doesn't work. So we're just not going to buy it because you don't buy stuff that doesn't pass the cost-benefit analysis. So you look at this and if you fund to find mutual assured destruction, and then it's like, if a nuclear war occurs and barring some sort of miracle, or where the adversary just really screws up. It's like, if you assume that the adversary makes like serious unforced errors, like nuclear war is winnable, but it's winnable because your opponent let you win, right? So like, for instance, it's like, oh, well, like if the like there's nuclear war and like one side is just this like, you know, their leader is just like, oh, well, it's like, I think this might be a false alarm and I'm just going to like take that chance. I'm going to write it out. And it's not a false alarm. And so the leadership gets killed and maybe they don't have that much of a survivable deterrent and they don't have some sort of like survivable nuclear command and control. This gets destroyed. So whatever weapons are left afterwards, like can't be launched anymore. It's like, well, the aggressor in this hypothetical scenario can win at nuclear war. It's like, it's not magical thinking to think that quote unquote nuclear war might be winnable. However, all of that scenario hinges on the other side being, in this case, stupid or at least, cooperating with the attacker in a sense.
Let me inject then artificial intelligence into this conversation. And I want to be clear because AI is another suitcase term, right? And like on this show, we're typically talking about generative adversarial networks or large language models. And that is not necessarily what you're talking about in your book, right?
Yes, right. So the AI, like as I point out, is like it's another one of these wonderful terms that, like among many many other things, artificial intelligence is just a brilliant piece of branding, right? So John McCarthy, the pioneering AI researcher, you know, like when he was putting together like the summer workshop at Dartmouth in 1956, that became was sort of like remembered as the founding moment of the field of artificial intelligence. He was trying to come up with a term that would get more interesting papers than the last workshop he put together. And so he comes up with this term. And ever since, it is like it has been reappropriated by different groups of people over time. So in the 1950s and 1960s, the predecessors of the people who are doing like the early neural network research, like Rosenblatt, for instance, they're like, they don't call themselves artificial intelligence researchers. So, like Rosenblatt actually explicitly says like, oh, like the artificial intelligence, what these other people are doing. I'm doing this other thing. That field was thought of as like pattern matching for a lot of this period. And then in the 1980s, there was old fashioned artificial intelligence that, you know, you've got knowledge engineering expert system sort of outfits like Technology. You've got like the list machine companies like Symbolics. It's like they're on one side. They're like the AI people. And then like the early connectionist neural network people are like a different group of people and they hate each other. It's like they hate each other with like the fire of a thousand suns. And it's only later that the term artificial intelligence is reappropriated by neural networks. And today it's like increasingly artificial intelligence is conflated with not just generative artificial intelligence, but these like large neural network sort of models. I personally prefer a more expansive understanding of artificial intelligence because I believe that there's a lot of this older stuff that deserves to be revisited, much as like the 19 neural networks in the U.S. are abandoned in the 1960s and 70s because the early neural networks, it was basically impossible to get them to do anything interesting. Then with combination of better algorithms and better compute than they had in the 50s, it's like they start being able to do a few things in sort of like around the beginning of the 80s. And then there's like this neural network renaissance. Much in a similar vein, it's like, oh, this like old timey AI from the 70s, this is like old and busted. And it's like, well, it's just worthless. And I look at this as like, I think a lot of these ideas from like the 60s and 70s and the early 80s, like the symbolic AI, I feel like there's an enormous amount of low hanging fruit of taking those ideas and combining them with the modern techniques. It's like, we've actually managed to inadvertently use neural networks to do some of the things that they were trying to do with knowledge engineering, where it's like, oh, well, like the thing we wanted this giant knowledge base for, can we just like build an LLM-like thing that'll serve as that knowledge base and combine it with these 1980s sort of explicit reasoning ideas to make like really powerful systems that get over the limitations of both of these two techniques. It's like, I feel like there's a huge amount of low-hanging fruit there that hasn't been explored. That said, it's like the particular applications I'm thinking about in my book are the ones that you would use in order to solve the military problems associated with trying to carry out a disarming strike against an adversary's nuclear arsenal. And so depending on quite how you go about that, some of that is like really quotidian, sort of. It's like, oh yeah, we want like better noise filters for anti-submarine warfare, right? It's like, we want to be able to filter out oceanic noise and like hear the adversary submarine moving around through all of like the whales singing and the, like the waves crashing and so forth in the ocean. So that's when, like, that's pretty quotidian. It's not Terminator. That's actually like enormously strategically important. And it's also something that is like with current technology, you need the data. But if you have a big oceanographic operation like major navies put together, it's like, that's actually not a problem. It's like, you go out, you put up a bunch of hydrophones, you collect a bunch of data, and you use it to train your models. And once you have those models, you can use them for like these militarily relevant things. It's not sexy. It's not a killer robot like hunting down surviving humans in a post-nuclear hellscape. But like, is this something that could like meaningfully change the military balance of power between like the U.S. and China and Russia and so forth? It's like, actually, yes, because the barrier to entry to some of these techniques, it used to be that the U.S. Navy was so far ahead of everyone else. And like this, the technology is creating opportunities for new rivals like China to really come in and like develop a sort of capability. And increasingly, it's also something that may be within the reach of like much more regional powers, right? Where it's like, so for instance, like Iran would be very interested in like making it harder for us to operate near them, right? It's like, they would like to make it so the Persian Gulf is more hostile to the U.S. Navy. It's like, well, like there are opportunities for them to do things like that. And some of them are not particularly sexy. They're a combination often of really low tech, old fashioned things that people have been doing for decades, or in some cases for centuries, with the enhanced by the modern technology.
Give me an example.
So like in a lot of ways, I would expect the AI military future to look a lot like the what we're currently familiar with. It's just, it's like, oh, well, we're using these technologies to enhance, or in some cases to automate, these processes that we've been doing for a long time.
Give me an example of one of those.
Right. So, well, to continue like the anti-submarine warfare theme, it's like, so the way that we historically did anti-submarine warfare against the Soviet Navy, right, was we're taking advantage of geography to hone in on, like, you have to start with sort of like a broad sense of where the adversary submarine is, right? Like there's this vision that some people have, it's just like, oh, what we do is we sort of like wait right outside of their submarine port with an attack submarine and wait for them to come out and then just follow it all the way along. And so it's like, I mean, in theory, that's possible. It's like, it's not that that's inconceivable. The way that we actually did it with most of the Cold War, though, is that it's like, so the Soviet submarines have missiles that can only actually reach the U.S. if they get out into the middle of the ocean. So it's like what NATO called the Yankee class submarine that's introduced in the late 60s. And so what happened was, as like, well, the Soviet submarines have to leave their ports like in Murmansk, basically. It's like, they have to leave the Sea of Murmansk. They have to come out of the Arctic. They have to come down through something that's called the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap. It's like, they have to come through this gap and then down into the middle of the Atlantic. And then that their patrol zone is down there. And then when their patrol time is over, they have to go around and like go back to the Soviet Union, right? So that involves having to go at relatively high speed for one of these submarines for this long distance. And furthermore, it's like, well, the GUIK gap, it's like, well, or GIUK gap. Well, all of those are like U.S. allies. And so, and also there's on top of sort of like this oceanic ridge. So it's like, oh yeah, we can just string a bunch of hydrophones out on top of there and listen. So what they had at the time, though, is like a bunch of guys like with headphones on listening to the hydrophones, like back in the 50s when they were setting this up. It's like, that's how it worked. And over the years, they're automating this more and more. Well, the sort of thing you might do today is like, okay, well, like we're going to replace all those guys with headphones, or like the simpler, the kinds of algorithms we have analyzing this today, we're going to replace it with all this deep learning stuff and hopefully get like a big performance enhancement. Then the next phase is like, okay, well, once you hear where a submarine might be, you start sending various sorts of tactical search assets after. And it might be anti-submarine warfare ships, also anti-submarine warfare planes that'll have different kinds of sensors on them, like magnetometers, for instance, right? And so you have all these sort of sources. It's like, well, it would be really nice if like we could take that and like save money by not using a manned vessel or a manned plane. We could have an unmanned drone with the same kind of sensors in it, or maybe enhanced version of those sensors. It's like, can we build a quantum magnetometer that would be more sensitive? People have proposed ideas like that. Physically possible, making it into a practical capability might be very difficult, perhaps totally impractical. But so basically we take the old fashioned sort of like Cold War style anti-submarine warfare kill chain, and we just start automating parts of it as possible. And like some of those things, you might need kinds of autonomy that are either not currently possible, or in some cases, we might be able to build, but we don't want to do it because of the enormous strategic consequences, right? It's like, oh, can we? Because often the idea with the final part of the kill chain is like there is an attack submarine. It's like all these things here where the noisy submarine was coming. And then it's like, okay, and then we just dispatch one of our attack submarines to come and start following it around. And like there are people who say in the early 70s, it's like the Soviet submarines almost always had an American submarine tailing them by the time they're out probing around in the middle of the ocean, right? And so it's like, well, then you have to finish up the kill chain. And there were various, there were anti-submarine rockets. You know, like this is an era when there were a lot of like tactical nuclear weapons that were intended for this mission, right? So you've got like anti-submarine rockets off of surface ships. You've got anti-submarine rockets off of attack submarines. You've got nuclear tip torpedoes. Like you've got depth charges. You've got all sorts of things. And it's like, okay, could we automate that last part of the kill chain? Can we build like an unmanned robot attack submarine that under certain circumstances will just try and start destroying what it thinks are enemy targets, right? And it's like, is that physically possible? Yes. Is that something you could try to do even with current day technology? I think so, but we wouldn't trust it with that because going around and destroying adversary vessels, even if it had relatively good friend or foe identification, which is one of the big sticky sort of parts of it. It's like, do we really want to entrust that kind of decision to a machine?
No.
Yeah. And so like, that's actually current US policy, is that we don't want to entrust this kind of decision to a machine. And there's also not a whole lot of, there's less demand from the military for sort of like these killer robots type of technologies than people often assume. It's like, some of that is because the professional military people, they think of themselves as like professional soldiers. They don't want to make themselves obsolete. That's one of the reasons. They also think of they think of themselves as being necessary. And in some cases, that's just sort of like being old fashioned. But in this case, it's just the moral question of like a lot of people are just sort of icked out by the idea of being killed by a machine that made the decision to kill someone on their own.
Isn't the heart of most near-miss nuclear stories that a human said, you know what, no, at some point in the kill chain?
I mean, there's never been an incident where somebody tried to push the button and the machine just didn't work. So in that sense, your statement is accurate. That said, it's like many of the near-miss stories, I mean, the extent to which the near-miss stories are actual near-misses is debated among the community of scholars who study these things. The thing that I find so scary is that we actually don't know how close we came. It raises the question of whether there are additional near misses that we just totally failed to recognize, we or the Soviets. Because some of what are currently like the celebrated near miss stories didn't come out until years after the fact.
So we could be sitting on near misses that we don't even know about that have nothing to do with humans.
Great.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I find disturbing. Well, fortunately, because of the way like the nuclear command and control is set up in like the major nuclear powers, because like the leaders of these countries have jealously tried to concentrate all of the nuclear use authority onto themselves. And they've developed like systems and procedures to try and enforce that in practice. It's the sort of like Dr. Strangelove scenario where like a general goes crazy and tries to start a nuclear war on his own. There were actually arrangements like that back in the early 60s that would have allowed someone to do something like that. And that's one of the reasons why the movie and like the other similar films and books came out. It's like, because this was like a realistic, plausible thing back then. In part because those movies came out and sort of highlighted the extent to which this was a terrible idea. We've made it increasingly so that it's like, okay, yeah, it's like we have these systems that are designed to make it so that if nuclear use is not authorized, it's like that weapon cannot be detonated, like hopefully cannot be launched. And so because of that, there is always, or in general, there's like a human at some point in the loop, but it may be just like, oh, well, like the president decides, right? And the computer says that there's like this adversary attack and the Mr. President is like, please decide whether we do something now, we try and write it out, so on and so forth. So there is, under the present arrangements, like there is like a human in the loop who gets a veto.
Do Russians think of it the same way that Americans do, to the extent that we know how the Russians think of it?
Yes. So there is the notorious Russian perimeter system, which is rather misunderstood, I think. So in the 1980s, the Soviets were very concerned about their vulnerability to a decapitating first strike from the United States. Basically, the idea that we could sort of like launch a nuclear weapon from close enough to the Soviet Union that would get very little warning and it could destroy Moscow and basically like kill the leadership. And they were very alarmed about, it's like, well, what does this mean for sort of like, and this was solely like, it only came out after the end of the Cold War that they were thinking this way. But what they ended up doing is like, they built this system that is sometimes characterized as a doomsday machine, but I really think that that isn't right. It's like, I think that based on my understanding of it, what it really is an automated system for delegating launch authority that it is not normally turned on. So it's like, instead of now, if like then the Soviet premier, today the Russian president, it's like, oh, well, the radar indicates that like there are missiles coming at us. And so therefore, like, here's your spectrum of options. It's like, there's like retaliate, like launch under attack to retaliate. But it also gives the Russian president other options. Like, okay, you can turn this thing on. If this thing is turned on, if after a certain period of time it detects nuclear explosions in the vicinity of Moscow and it can no longer contact the leadership, meaning that the Russian president has probably been killed, it will begin delegating launch authority initially to a couple of like super hardened command centers with like particular people who are presumably vetted for this purpose, and that they will have the opportunity to use the sort of like backup, sort of like a way of communicating with Soviet nuclear, or not so then originally Soviet, now Russian nuclear forces. That's where the perimeter name comes in. Perimeter is the signal rocket. It's this thing is basically an ICBM, but instead of having a nuclear warhead on the top of it, it's got this transmitter that's transmitting as like some sort of like launch signals, essentially. So like, so in theory, under the scenario, presuming that it happens, is like you would assume that if you turn the system on and the set of circumstances that are supposed to trigger it actually happens. So it's like it takes nuclear explosions in Moscow and the leadership has apparently been killed. And like, presumably like a lot of Soviet or Russian nuclear forces are not left in this scenario at this point. So, because you would expect that there would be try and decapitate the leadership, destroy their nuclear command and control system, and then try and like thin out their actual offensive forces as much as possible.
It's basically a computerized version of the UK's letters of last resort, right?
After a fashion, although the letters of the last resort are mysterious and that nobody actually knows what's in them.
Well, no, you don't know until you open the safe, right?
Well, you don't know until you open the envelope.
Well, fair enough. Emily, real briefly.
But yeah, it's like every prime minister writes a letter of last resort. And like, I'm not even sure if they're preserved. They may be destroyed at the end of the prime minister's term. Yeah.
Yeah. I need to know a little bit more about what this is just to really make sure that I don't get any sleep tonight.
yeah. So then the British nuclear retaliatory force, right, is based on submarines carrying nuclear missiles. Right. And so what they have on the submarine, in case that Britain ends up getting destroyed, and before they can get the like a signal off to the submarines about what to do, it's like before the prime minister can decide, like there's no signal transmitted to the submarines. It just is like the submarine puts up its antenna and it just like tries to find out what's happened. And then it just is like, yeah, Britain is gone. Like there's nobody there to give you any commands anymore. So what they have for those circumstances is that the, like, each British prime minister writes a letter that is then placed in the safes on these submarines. And, like, only the captain has a key to the safe. And under those circumstances, the captain is supposed to take the letter out, read it, and do whatever it says.
In the submarine. This is like a safe inside the submarine with this letter. Yeah, it's the captain's
safe in the submarine.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so they're supposed to read it, and it might say, like, okay, go to America or Australia. It could say, it's like, launch him if you want. It could say, do not actually use the weapons under any circumstances. It could say anything, right? And it's not clear, because the different prime ministers all get to write something, and it doesn't become public. It's like, it's not actually clear what the letters over the years have said since they've,
like,
been doing.
Go to Antarctica, start Britain 2. Like, it's like...
It could be, yeah, it could be literally anything. It could be, that's, you know, wild. Go ahead and launch your nukes at whoever got us. Yeah, and we don't know, and I think they do destroy the letters.
Do they still produce these? Do, like, current prime ministers still put these out?
So far as I know, the arrangement hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm. All right, cyber listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All right, cyber listeners, welcome back. We were talking about nuclear war and artificial intelligence. So anyway, like, Russia, like, it's really funny because this is a good example of kind of like we were talking about yesterday in another show we talked about, like, the big AI stories coming out this year. Rather than thinking about, like, a top-down Skynet situation, you really got to think about AI taking over all these little tasks, right? So you automate a process like this, which appears to be what you're talking, like, kind of what Russia is trending towards, and what we're trending towards is finding the small tasks in the chain, like the in automating them, right?
Well, so in this case, it's automated in a sense that they want to have a secure ability to, like, try and delegate launch authority, but at the same time, one of the accounts, like Bruce Blair. When he was started publicizing Perimeter back, like, in the early 90s, put forward this narrative. It's like, oh, well, like, the system eventually will, like, start launching weapons on its own. And even, like, gave this lurid description of, like, oh yeah, it's like a mobile missile launcher will just stop moving despite the people driving it, will, like, rate, like, launch itself. That was just, like, absolute rank nonsense. Like, that is not at all how these systems work. It's not clear where Perimeter stops delegating launch authorities. Like, my guess would be that at some point it may, if enough of the system survives, it may start sending sort of launch them if you've got them messages to whatever submarines and mobile missile launchers and ICBM launch control centers that are actually left, leaving it in the hands of, so for instance, the guys, like, a lot of the Russian forces, like these road mobile ICBMs, right? And so these road mobile ICBMs, what they actually don't drive around most of the time. Most of the time, they're sort of, like, camouflaged and out hiding in the forest or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're just sitting out there hiding in the forest, and there's nuclear war. And it's like, under these circumstances where this would happen, you'll be able to see the nuclear war because, like, you'll know what's going on because you can see the explosions. It's like, you know, there'll be sort of, like, flashes over the horizon and stuff like that. And so they're just sort of sitting out there in the forest, and then it's like, okay, like, what do we do? Because, like, under normal circumstances, it's not like somebody in the missile launcher can go crazy and just go in there and it's like, I stole the keys and, like, turn the keys and actually have the thing work, right? It's like they have to get a signal from somewhere, but it may be eventually that this automated system, if you kill the Russian president and then say it's like somehow like these ultra hardened command centers are also destroyed, it may be that there's enough of this system that it's survivable enough that at a certain point it'll be like, oh, yeah, like, it just sends out the message. It's like, here's the launch code. Decide what you're going to do.
I would say that feeding into this uncertainty about how this stuff will work in the event of a nuclear launch is part of where we are now, right? Like, it's deterrence through, what is it? It's the title of your book, right?
And it is true that, like, one of the major themes in my book is that nuclear strategy is, like, really about knowledge quality problems. So both in terms of like trying to define what the problem really is. So for instance, like, does the adversary really need to be deterred? It's like, does Vladimir Putin really wake up every morning and just try and say, it's like, should I nuke America today? It's because often like formal discussions of deterrence actually talk about it that way. There's sort of this implicit notion that like every day they're making conscious decisions. It's just this like, it's like, oh, like I really want to nuke America, but what will happen to us? You know, like it's like, oh, well, like today doesn't look like a good day, but maybe tomorrow will be different. So it's like, I'll continue to revisit this. I don't think this is generally how it works, even with people who are, shall we say, not averse to violent aggression, like Putin has demonstrated himself to be, that most of the time, like actually using the nuclear weapons, in at least in an offensive way, is unthinkable, but also unthought, in that like the leaders actually aren't thinking actively about engaging in nuclear aggression. That could change very rapidly. And there's also always the possibility of sort of like a latter day kind of Hitler who would be risk acceptant and might even sort of have the attitude of like some sort of bizarre set of preferences. But we have to grapple firstly with the uncertainty of, it's like, what does the adversary really want? It's like, do they need to be deterred? Do we need to be worried about circumstances under which they would require like actual sort of like practical deterrence where they're actually having this calculation I was talking about? But there's also these questions of, it's like, okay, well, if nuclear weapons are used, what happens? And a lot of this, the scientific understanding of this is not nearly as good as I would like it to be. It's like, we know less from atmospheric nuclear testing than people often assume that we do. And some of that is because even back in the 50s, when we did these, what in hindsight were these astonishingly irresponsible and dangerous atmospheric nuclear tests, there were tests that needed to be done to sort of understand what the military use cases would be like that we didn't do because they were considered too dangerous even then. So our ability to like take the models that were developed back in those days using the incomplete data that we had and then try and extrapolate what like a serious nuclear war is actually going to look like, or even a very minor nuclear war, we can't predict with like a high degree of confidence, and maybe not even, you know, like much confidence at all about like what will actually happen. Like if we launch this nuke and it goes off here, what will happen? It's like, where will the fallout go? How bad will it be? Will the blast effects like actually destroy the target like we are hoping that they will? There are a lot of uncertainties even about the very basic scientific stuff.
That's so wild to me that like we don't even know really if the effect that we want will be achieved.
So, well, the way we normally deal with this in practice, for better or worse, is to just build a lot of overkill into the targeting plans. So the notion is like, we want to exceed this probability that we think that this target will be destroyed. And we've been conservative in the sense of like assuming that like, oh, this adversary missile silo, for instance, is like, we're going to assume that it can survive like this amount of overpressure when it may very well only be able to survive like some fraction of that. And once you build that kind of conservatism into the targeting sort of procedure, it's like, this is one of the reasons during the Cold War that we ended up with just like preposterous numbers of weapons, because they're using this kind of math and you end up with ludicrous numbers of weapons. There's the question of like, okay, well, like, do we actually get a better deterrent because we're doing it this way, particularly because like this is all like very secret, right? So it's not like we're like, it's like inviting like Soviet ambassador, come in here into our targeting room, we're going to show you how our numbers are, aren't you deterred? This is not how we do it, right? It's like all of this is like so secret that it's kept secret even from, historically it was notoriously secret even from like the U.S. civilian leadership. It's like that the military was sort of like hoarding this for themselves. And when civilians came asking questions, they were generally sort of like given the runaround until the late 80s. This was something that was done with like, in hindsight, what was not proper civilian oversight.
This goes to a quote kind of at the end of your book that I really like, that is about both AI and nukes. One lamentable parallel between nuclear weapons and artificial intelligence is that both topics elicit an astonishing degree of magical thinking from otherwise intelligent people, including some with genuine expertise. Why do you think both nukes and AI make people prone to fantasy?
Part of it comes back to these knowledge quality problems that, like, because we don't have great examples of we don't have the artificial general intelligence yet, and we haven't had, I mean, there's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but we haven't had sort of like a proper nuclear war. And so, but there's this intuition that either of these things could like these hugely important momentous events. Both of them get at these issues of like the nature of humanity, like the humanity either is, to the extent with nuclear wars, the question is like, okay, well, like, could humanity sort of end? It's like, it's been the fear, even before nuclear weapons were actually invented, is like, there was this notion of, it's like, oh, you could build like these weapons harnessing atomic energy that might be this, like, pose this enormous existential threat to humanity, right? And then with artificial intelligence, their fears that it's like, oh, well, like, if we created it, like, it'll destroy humanity one way or another, or lead to some other bad outcome. But there's also just this concern that, or intuition many people have, is like, inventing artificial intelligence will prove that human beings are not special. That, in fact, like, either because just proving that humans aren't unique in the universe, or proving that human intelligence was never particularly interesting or important. And so, like, it gets at these sort of, like, primal concerns that is, like, it's challenging our sense of, like, who we are as human beings, either because it's, like, there's a intuition that people had for a lot of history that humanity basically couldn't cease to exist. And alternatively, it's like the idea that you could ever create something that was sort of human-like in some sense was either considered to be impossible or some sort of like horrible demonic thing that you like arcane arts that you absolutely shouldn't trot on because they are like, it's trading on God's domain or something like that.
It's a very existential kind of question, both of them.
Yes. So even though it's not necessarily in terms of existential risk.
Well, I mean, some would argue that AI is an existential risk, right? Like, that's the big push from a lot of effective altruists, right, which are dominating the field of AI and AI security specifically, that they think they do see it as an existential risk on par with nuclear weapons, including, I always screw up his name, the less wrong guy. You actually quote him in your book a couple times.
Yeah, Elisa Yudkowsky.
Yes. Do you see AI as an equivalent existential risk?
So one of the reasons why I'm hesitant to answer this question gets back at what I was saying a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Like, the thing that worries me most as somebody who does this for a living is that we actually don't have a great, like, our knowledge of how dangerous the nuclear danger is so fuzzy that it's like, I'm trying to judge this. It's like, okay, well, like, the AI risks are fuzzier, but it's like, oh, is it on par with nuclear weapons? It's like, I'm actually not sure where the nukes fall, right? It's like, we don't know. It's like, like, it's not like I can come up with an estimate. It's like someone comes to me and it's like, okay, Dr. Geist, please, like, tell us, what percentage do you think is, like, what is the probability of nuclear war in, like, the next year or the next month or the next 5 minutes or the next century? And it's just, it's like, okay, well, like, I can tell you as a historian that it's like, it's oscillated. Like, I have intuitions about what it was like at different points in the past that might be wrong. You know, it's like, before I was in this role, I was a historian of these things. It's like, I got into it because I was interested in nuclear things and nukes were over and now they came back. Right.
Right.
But this question, I was like, okay, intuitively, it seems that risk of nuclear war is usually assumed that the Cuban Missile Crisis is the height of the risk of nuclear war during the Cold War. There are these other moments, like 61 Berlin Crisis was probably not as bad as the Cuban Missile Crisis, but seems to be a lot better than like an average, a lot worse than an average day. 1983, it's like, it's very debated. And there are some historians who argue that the risk of nuclear war in late 83 has been wildly exaggerated. I think that I'm actually on the fence about 83. It's like, I don't think that we have good enough documents to get a good sense. But also, the thing that worries me most as a historian studying this thing is just this, like, you can't tell from the documents. It's like, the documents is like, we have like the XCOM meeting minutes where like Kennedy and his associates like talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's just like, okay, we have that. We have a lot more Soviet documents than we used to have, but not the equivalent of that. And it's like, okay, like, looking at all this, trying to align this with what we can reconstruct about like the actual posture of nuclear forces and what was going on. It's like, there are all these question marks. It's like, we just don't know. And so getting back to these AI questions that are much fuzzier, and I look at it and it's like, okay, I actually don't feel comfortable making the comparison, in part because I don't know what the nuclear baseline is.
And in the absence of the knowledge, this is another kind of theme of your book. We end up relying a whole lot on popular culture.
Right. And so in my book, I lean into the pop culture portrayals, firstly, because I know from experiences like this, these are the touchstones that everybody reaches for. It's like, it's not just, you know, people on the internet. It's like, it's also like, you know, you talk to policy officials and like they bring up Strangelove, they bring up Terminator, they bring up war games. It's like there are these touchstones that everybody keeps referring back to. And so my strategy with the book is like, okay, well, I should lean into this. It's like, because everybody knows these things, if they're right, I should just point out, it's like, well, it's like in the movie. And then you can talk about it in the movie. And in other cases, like, okay, it's not really like in the movie. And here's why it's not like in the movie. So keep things as entertaining and light as I can, given the rather depressing nature of the overall subject matter.
I mean, but you're bringing up, like, I have no mouth, but I must scream, which is not a very, cheery story. Like, a lot of the fiction is very depressing, too, right? A lot of the fiction is nightmare fuel as well.
Right. Well, like, how many happy post-nuclear stories are there? I guess Star Trek is technically one of these narratives, but it's not normally played as such. It's like, oh, there's a nuclear war, and then the Vulcans come, and we sort of, like, unlearn all the bad stuff somehow. Yeah, so it's one of the things I emphasize in the book, though, is that these stories resonate with us so much because they are compelling narratives, not because they have that much of a resemblance to real life. So, like, for instance, the idea is like, oh, well, the military really wants to build like a sentient nuclear war plant in computers, like they want to build a Whopper or Skynet. Like, in practice, the real world U.S. military bureaucracy has very little interest in such a thing. Not least of which, like, they're both for the good reasons that it's like, oh, we believe that this should be the prerogative of human beings, and we have to have human beings overseeing this process at every point. And even if that slows it down a lot compared to what would have been technologically possible even decades ago, we're just going to do it that way. There's also the bad reasons, which is like, we've always done it this way with this bureaucracy, and we're going to continue doing it this way with this bureaucracy because bureaucracy perpetuates itself. But the reality, though, is just this, like, it's not like somebody's putting out a request for proposals to military contractors. It's like, please, like, design us like a sentient nuclear war planning computer that will think about all possible nuclear scenarios and then take over for the president in case of war. It's like, nobody is asking for that. But it's been the first story with that narrative that I was able to identify was published in 1948. And by the mid-50s, these stories were already ubiquitous. It's like before the term artificial intelligence was invented, stories of nuclear-armed computers run amok and stories of robots like fighting humans in a post-nuclear hellscape. It's like these are common, well-established tropes by the mid-50s, and they just continue. So it's like today we tend to remember them through their 1980s sort of interpretation. So we've got James Cameron's Terminator, which is basically it's an extraordinarily well-constructed horror film, basically, right? But it's taking these tropes that you find in these like 1950s sci-fi narratives, you know, like stories by people like Philip K. Dick, and like turning them into this horror film about like this robot from the future that comes and is like trying to kill people. And then we have War Games, which is both this combination of what were then very trendy, sort of like you have like the video game theme in the early 80s video game fad, early sort of like home computer hackers, which was like, that was a novel theme in 1983. It's like, it's a stale trope now, but like at this point it's like, it's maybe the first portrayal of it that gets a wide audience. Right. But it's also combined with the early artificial intelligence research. It's like the character of Professor Falcon is sort of like a cross between, you know, Thomas Schelling and like John McCarthy. In that is like, if you zoom in really close in the movie, I watched the movie very closely when writing my book, if you can tell. It's like, if you zoom in really closely, it's like at one point Matthew Broderick's character like goes to the library to try and learn about Professor Falcon. And it's like he's reading Falcon's dissertation, and like in the microfiche screen, like shows the title of the dissertation. And it's like, you know, magazine articles that were like the movie makers dreamt up about what Professor Falcon had done early in his career, and like the movies of Falcon like doing research in the early 60s. And it's pulling on these sort of like early AI research sort of both things that actually existed in real life at places like MIT and Stanford in the late 50s, early 60s, but also like combining it with these other sort of visions. Now, the figure of the combined, like, artificial intelligence researcher and nuclear strategist that Professor Falcon apparently was. That's something, it didn't quite exist in real life in that form, but it was real in the sense that the Rand Corporation in the 1950s was at the forefront of both of these things. It's just that the nuclear strategists and what were later termed AI researchers are not the same people, right?
Yeah.
So
one of the things that I thought was really interesting about the book was you kind of walk through, we've gone through boom and bust cycles of hype around AI many times before, which I'd never quite picked up on. I've always kind of thought of AI in this current moment. I've never really dug into the past. Can you kind of walk us through some of those?
Yes. So there's this term AI winter that was invented in the 80s to describe the basically the collapse of the expert systems and list machine companies in that era. But there have been, it's debated how many AI winters there have been, but there have been at least two and maybe more depending on how you count them. So you start at the beginning of the field in the mid-50s. So what was remarkable at the time, like there were not that many people doing this research, but the overall like average quality of like those personnel was, I think on average, like extraordinarily high. So you've got like your Minskys, your McCarthys, your Newells, like Simon, like people like that. Like small community. But what happened at the time, though, is just like, well, they start, like at the time, it wasn't obvious that you could make computers do anything that remotely resembled cognitive work, right? It's like, oh, well, computers, like they just do math. It's like they, well, there were people who seriously argue, like computers will never be able to play chess because chess is like, this is a cognitive task and like computers by definition can't do cognitive tasks. So it's like mid-50s, we start getting like real world game playing programs. We start getting the earliest sort of like artificial intelligence programs of other kinds. So it's like what was arguably, depending on how you define it, the earliest artificial intelligence program was developed by Newell and Simon and actually run here at Rand. It was implemented by a guy named Cliff Shaw. And so at the time, it's like the delta from no computers and nothing remotely deserving the term AI to getting these incredibly primitive vacuum tube computers to do something that resembled cognitive work. And so it's like you measure that delta and people like Newell were just as like, oh, like we're going to have human level AI like within the next 10 or 15 years because look at this. It's like we've gone from nothing to something. And so clearly it's like we'll go from something to like finishing everything pretty quickly. Now, there was a self-selection effect, right, where people like you have to be pretty crazy to do what today would be, or at least pretty, you have to be pretty confident to do what would today be considered artificial general intelligence research using vacuum tube computers. Or in the case of like McCarthy and Minsky initially, because they couldn't afford time on computers, no computers. They're just doing theoretical work best they can for several years before they actually get access to a computer, right? So you go from that, and then it's like, well, by the mid-60s, it's becoming clear it's like the kind of progress that was being anticipated a few years before is just not like is not in prospect. And so then there's this notion of like, oh, there is this machine intelligence research and it's kind of been a bust. And so the government, both the US and the UK governments, kind of pull the money back that had been going to this, or at least a lot of it. Then in the late 70s, it's mostly forgotten now, but what actually happened was that the DoD had sponsored research on a voice recognition system that worked well enough that it created a conviction. This and some other sort of like expert systems work. So it created a conviction. It's like, oh, well, the technology is finally coming to a point where it might be commercially useful. And so in the early to mid 80s, there's this like flurry of interest in expert systems and these list machines that were supposed to be used to develop these expert systems. And by the standards of like previously, there had not been the extent to which there was an AI industry earlier depends on quite how you define it. What was it? There were some earlier companies that might be considered AI companies, like Systran existed earlier, but basically though, this is the first time there's like an AI industry is in like the early 80s, and you've got both custom hardware companies and software companies. So within a few years, it becomes apparent like the expert systems have been like vastly overhyped. And the list machines were also just like far too expensive, even though they're legendary among people who use them because they were like the ultimate hacker machines.
Right.
But they also cost like more than a house. It's like a single user workstation that costs more than a house. and was outdated within a couple of years. You wonder why the company didn't, the companies that made them sort of like got out of that business at least. So that there's that collapse, but it also coincided with the rise of neural networks. So neural networks are revived. And so there was also like briefly, there were like neural network companies. And so there is the brief hope that it's like, oh, there'll be rapid progress in neural networks. At the time, this is disappointing. It's like neural networks had kind of just fallen out of vogue in the late 90s because there was also this neural net winter, disappointment with neural nets. And it's only some, it depends on how you measure it. It's like, it's really, deep learning's moment really starts in the early 2010s when you start, like, you, the people really start leveraging the GPUs. So we go through this whole series of cycles, and it's just like, well, there's AI, there are these AI winter periods. Arguably, there's like AI winter in the 60s and 70s, but people can't define like exactly when and it started and ended. But there's definitely the AI winter of the 1980s that is the collapse of these expert system companies. And so there's the speculation. It's like, oh, are we in for like another sort of like, could another sort of like bust cycle occur? And the current moment is so strange in the sense that both the genuine progress and the hype are both so completely beyond what has existed historically. And also, perhaps most importantly, the amount of money and human resources that are being devoted to the field are so much higher than at any point in the past that even if the overwhelming majority of the field is basically people trying to leverage sort of like existing, they're just like taking your existing frameworks like Keras or maybe even scikit-learn and like I'm trying to apply it to their problem, right? There's still the fact that this is like, you know, like all the smart kids trying to get into the field at once. Some of them will be sort of like looking under some of like the unoverturned rocks, and like we might get this rapid sort of progress that people imagine. So it's gonna be an interesting period, I think. If there's anything that I would listen, I draw from the history though, is like if I had to bet money, like the field will probably be very different like 10 years from now than it is today. It's like I don't expect the current software approaches. It's like the whole current paradigm, I would not bet huge money on the current paradigm of it's like, oh, well, we're going to have these enormous models that are so expensive to train and run. And that like the reason that I'm skeptical about that is just like this is not economical under current circumstances. And it's like the current approach to it's like, oh, we're going to solve the limitations of the models by making the models bigger. But it just is like, well, like the lines, like you're already losing money on the current model. And even if you're assuming continued progress on the hardware side, it's like, it's not clear when those lines cross. It's like all the incentives are to making things that are more efficient, hopefully more modular. I think like the recent, the new Mistral LLM that'll run on much lighter hardware, I feel like is already like a significant evolution point towards the sort of paradigm I would anticipate. And so therefore we shouldn't bet too much either in terms of like companies would be wise not to assume that the future is going to look like the present. It's like I feel like the giant frontier model era may be very short lived because all of the economic and other incentives seem to be pointing towards trying to get away from it. But furthermore, it's like we shouldn't set up a regulatory regime that is based on the assumption that the intermediate term or even possibly the near term. It could be that as we were recording this, like the archive paper is being posted that like describes the new paradigm that everybody's going to be using like within the next year, right? Because the incentives are so high. It's like these models, it's remarkable what they can do. Their limitations also shouldn't be like one of the themes of my book is that you can't reason with knowledge you don't have.
Right.
And the big question about these big models is what knowledge is actually in them? It's like, what do they actually represent? What if you can like, there's this fear that maybe these big models will do some kind of information fusion and will actually be able to like draw inferences that humans, because they don't actually have as much knowledge in some sense, individual humans at least, haven't been able to draw. I feel like that's an open empirical question. The assumption that they can, I feel, that is not my intuition. Like, I feel like it's not the case. The current systems, for a variety of reasons, I think are actually not great at the kind of information fusion that people are afraid that they'll be capable of. That said, it's like, oh, well, do I think it's categorically impossible to architect a system that would have those properties? Like, I don't think that's the case at all. And it could be that somebody has already invented that system out now that all the labs are being so secretive and there's like a lot of work being done in various various corners. So, you know, it's like I wouldn't want to state that it's like, oh, well, like it's like, oh, it's all totally overhyped. You don't need to worry about anything. I feel like that's going way too far in the Sanguine direction. But also this notion of just as like, oh, it's inevitable that it's like we're going to have recursively self-improving AGI in a couple of years and it's going to destroy humanity. So I should just like sit around like, I don't know, eating Twinkies or whatever you're supposed to do if you feel like the world is going to end. And it's just like I feel like that's overblown as well. But like at the same time, it's like it's really hard to prove the negative that that's like the far out scenarios. It's like how can I prove there isn't going to be a nuclear war tomorrow? Right. It's like they're probably like, I don't think there's going to be, but like actually can't say it's like, well, I like, cause the simple reality is that someone like Vladimir Putin can wake up and just like, I think I'm going to start a nuclear war today. And if his subordinates don't stop him, he can do that.
I feel like a great place to put our flag here at the end of the conversation is embrace uncertainty and admit that there's a bunch of stuff that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. It's like the real, I feel like both in AI policy and nuclear policy, and especially in the intersection that my book is about, it's a matter of trying to manage uncertainty, both our own uncertainties and other people's uncertainties. And so and also not to talk ourselves into believing that we know more than we really do.
Edward, thank you so much for coming on to Cyber and walking us through this. Where can people find the book?
So it is available for purchase on the internet, although I should add the caveat that it is currently sold out and Oxford University Press is promising that they will be printing more soon. So
it's a hot topic. People are very interested and it's a good book. So,
oh, well, I'm flattered to hear you say that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Transitioning to a decarbonized economy sounds like just one change. In fact, this shift requires several transitions across sectors, geographies, and timelines. In Talking Transitions, a new podcast brought to you by the EY organization and Foresight Climate and Energy, we look at how the transition is affecting three key areas: energy, financial services, and government. The Talking Transitions podcast is out now. Download today from wherever you get your podcasts or visit talkingtransitions.com to find out more.